You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Peter Godwin has reported from over 65 countries as a foreign correspondent, but his latest book is about his return to his native Zimbabwe to deal with the loss of his father in a country that is losing everything. The New York Times' Michiko Kakutani called it haunting and beautifully written. When A Crocodile Eats the Sun, A Memoir of Africa, is published by Little Brown, and I'm very pleased it has brought Peter Godwin to my show today. Hello.
Hi.
So when does A Crocodile Eat the Sun?
Well, A Crocodile Eats the Sun in this particular context, when there is a total eclipse of the sun, when there is a solar eclipse, and the events in this book are bracketed by two such total solar eclipses, really almost within the space of 2 years, which is statistically extremely rare. And some of the tribes in Zimbabwe believe that that an eclipse is caused when the celestial crocodile briefly consumes our life-giving star as a warning that he's displeased with our behavior.
So this grows out of pre-Christian religions?
Indeed, it does, and does. And it's also...
Are they still alive in Zimbabwe?
Those religions, yes, absolutely, and often blended into some form of Christianity. They sort of coexist, yes.
As a journalist, you are trained to write objectively. Did that make it more difficult for you to write about your own life and your own background?
Absolutely. I mean, this is my second memoir. So I was sort of broken, and I wrote a book called Makiwa, which was about being a child and growing up in Zimbabwe. But I found that very difficult after being trained to really write at one remove, all of a sudden plunging into one's intimate life. I found that very difficult, and it took me a long time to lose that reserve.
Makiwa's subtitle was A White Boy in Africa, and that's really important, especially in the case of Zimbabwe, which was Rhodesia, a country that was run as though it were a white nation, even though the majority of the people were black.
Absolutely, and Makiwa dealt with the rise of black nationalism, with the liberation war itself, and up through independence. And I think part of the reason I put the white boy in that title was really to signal that it really was a memoir seen from my point of view, that I wasn't writing it on behalf of all Zimbabweans. It was a partial view.
Was it a happy time for a white boy in Rhodesia?
You know, when I was a little boy, it was a very happy time, I'm slightly ashamed to say. I mean, we lived in a very remote area, right on the Mozambique border. My mother was a doctor practicing in the tribal areas, the only doctor for thousands of square miles. My father managed a series of big estates, and I was more or less left to my own devices, and brought up principally by local women from the Ndau tribe. And it was a very happy time for me. I didn't know any better. Then it came to a relatively abrupt halt when our next door neighbor was murdered, and that was really the first attack of what was to become the liberation war.
How had your family come to Zimbabwe in the first place? I should say Rhodesia, shouldn't I?
Well, I think it's people of below a certain age, I don't think, can remember where Rhodesia was. I think I'm probably aging myself. But
even the name, of course, smacks of British colonialism, named after Cecil Rhodes.
Right. Although, oddly, I mean, you know, a very weird brand of colonialism, because it was sort of franchised out to him. I mean, he had enormous confrontations with Whitehall, with the British government. So it was a sort of rather uneasy colonialism, more like a cowboy colonialism.
And now all we have is the Rhodes scholarships in this country named after him.
We have the Rhodes scholarships, yes, and yes, and that, I think that's
what no Rhodesia anymore.
No.
So I ask you, how did your family end up in Rhodesia, Zimbabwe?
They emigrated, like a lot of Brits, immediately after the Second World War. It's easy to forget now just how miserable England was immediately after the war, that its industry had been shattered by German bombs. It was very depressed. The economy was very depressed. And there were very few opportunities. And also it owed America a huge amount of money from Lend-Lease during the war. So huge numbers, thousands and thousands of Brits screamed overseas to Australia and New Zealand and Canada and here and to Southern Africa. And of course, all of Africa really then was still colonies. It wasn't really until Macmillan's Wind of Change speech, and I think Ghana was the first country to become independent in about 1957. So at the time I'm talking about, you know, the late 40s, early 50s, it seemed a sanctuary from the sort of awfulness and the barbarity of Europe, which from the point of view of 1945 had these two Second World Wars had had pogroms and the Holocaust and all sorts of things. So they were part of that big migration.
But in the case of Rhodesia and South Africa, even after Britain no longer was the colonial power, they tried to hold on to the old ways, and that's why there was that civil war. And wasn't your older sister Jane killed during the civil war?
Yes, my older sister was killed in 1978 together with her fiancé and their best man 10 days before what was supposed to be their wedding. And by then I had gone to university. I was at Cambridge in England and came back ultimately, I mean, for a funeral that was supposed to have been a wedding.
Did that force your family to consider leaving or leaving? I guess it was still Rhodesia?
Yes, it was on the cusp of changing. I mean, there was a sort of weird little phase where there was a guy called Bishop Abel Muzarewa who was sort of taking over. But then in 1980, Mugabe took over. No, oddly, my parents became, if anything, even more stubborn about staying after Jane was killed. I think it was almost once you start burying your own flesh and blood in the soil, it really becomes home to you, and you leave with greater difficulty almost.
Do you have any theories as to why you and your sister Georgina both became journalists?
Well, it was the enormous disappointment of my parents, who were both technocrats, and the environment in Rhodesia, Zimbabwe then was one of a sort of pioneer society. People were very practical. My dad could fix anything. He was an electrical, mechanical, mining, and water engineer, and that was the sort of person you needed in Africa to be a good man in Africa. And liberal arts was something that really was rather despised. So I think, on one level, they were rather disappointed that all their children, none of us became technocrats at all. But they made their peace with it in the end, I think. Maybe we did it as in sort of reaction to who they were. That often happens.
When white rule ended, were most people feeling optimistic about the future?
Well, it depends how you define that. A lot of white people left in the sort of year or two. A lot of them left during the Civil War. A lot of them left when they realized there was going to be black rule. And if you remember, where a lot of them went to was to South Africa, which at that time was still under apartheid. So the people who stayed actually were probably the more liberal whites, the ones who weren't allergic to the prospect of black rule, the ones who were much more hopeful about the future. And my parents would certainly number among them.
And did they have faith in the new leadership? Kanan Banana and Robert Mugabe.
Right. Robert Mugabe was always the sort of real power. I mean, he did this astonishing thing where he had been a rather militant Marxist in his utterances, and he almost immediately did a volte-face and became this sort of moderate capitalist. And one of the big issues,
almost Nelson Mandela-like,
absolutely,
initially,
and preached racial reconciliation in the way that Mandela later did. And one of his big U-turns was on land, actually, where he decided, interesting enough, on the advice of Samora Machel, who'd been the new president in neighboring Mozambique and who'd sheltered him during the Liberation War. And Machel had nationalized the whole of the Mozambican economy, and 500,000 Portuguese settlers left in a matter of months, and the economy collapsed and really never recovered. Michel said to Mugabe, you know what, you might as well keep your whites. They can be quite useful, and they're better than expats because they keep their money there, they spend their money there, and also they're no political threat at all because they've just been defeated. So they'll be amazingly grateful that you've allowed them to stay and probably quite loyal. And he was absolutely right. So Mugabe appointed a white minister of agriculture and toured the farming areas and said to the white farmers, stay and contribute to the new society, which they did.
My guest is Peter Godwin, who's written a memoir. He calls it a memoir of Africa, called When a Crocodile Eats the Sun, published in this country by Little Brown. So how long did the honeymoon last?
Well, that depends on who you ask. I mean, for me personally, very, very brief time. I came back. In fact, I bought an old truck and I drove overland from Oxford, where I was struggling to do a PhD that I don't think I ever finished in the end. It did become a book, though. So, and I spent a year driving down Africa to get back to Zimbabwe to work on the thesis, which was about the war, actually, a war that I'd fought in but never really fully understood.
And you had fought in it as a as a supporter of the white rule.
Right. I was drafted, as all white men were. I was drafted at
the Ian Smith government.
Right. Right. I mean, Ian Smith and then Mozarewa. I mean, it was, and I was, I just turned 17 when I was drafted. And you had to go after high school before you could be released to go to university. So I did some time, probably 2 years altogether in that war. After independence, I mean, I arrived there in probably a year after independence, but very optimistic and part of this wanting to contribute to this big, new, bold experiment. We were going to create this multiracial, post-colonial country, and we were going to show that it could be done. And bear in mind that Zimbabwe had a very high literacy rate, very, very well-educated population, and an infrastructure like none other in Africa. This wasn't a sort of typical African country by any stretch.
So there hadn't been apartheid in the same way as there had been to the south. If there was high literacy, then education was a lot better.
Yes, it was. I mean, there was racism, and it was institutional, but it wasn't nearly as hermetically sealed and as sort of rather brutally enforced as it was in South Africa. The country was just too small, and also there was a sort of brand of, I suppose you'd call it paternalism. I mean, that, you know, sort of, you know, quote unquote benign paternalism. So the infrastructure and the roads and things were actually rather good, even under white rule. The education rate for blacks was quite good. But it has to be said that in those first few years, Mugabe put a lot of money into the health system and a lot of money into education. But very early on, in really 1983, there'd been tension between these two different guerrilla armies that had fought for independence, Mugabe's on the one hand, and another group called ZAPU under Joshua Nkomo. And this tension got worse and worse, and eventually Mugabe sent a North Korean-trained unit of his army called the 5th Brigade down into the southern provinces of Matabeleland, where they basically committed a massacre. I mean, we still don't know how many people were killed, probably in the region of 20,000. And I went down, I'd heard about it because I'd worked as a lawyer, which is what I'd qualified as, and I'd represented some of these Matabele generals. And I went down there and reported on it, and Zimbabwe was never the same for me after that.
And Nkomo being supported by Mozambique or
no? Originally, Nkomo being supported by the Russians and Mugabe being supported by the Chinese. This was the height of the Cold War, of course. So they were supposedly allies, but then they fell out basically after independence.
And this memoir begins in the summer of 1996 with you returning to Africa. So you'd been away for quite a time as you were working as a journalist?
Right. After I reported on the Matabeleland massacres in 83 and 84, I was declared an enemy of the state and thrown out. And so I then reported. I was eventually, after a stint in Eastern Europe, I was posted to South Africa, where I reported on the last days of apartheid, an extraordinary story. And still sort of could get back into Zimbabwe now and then, but wasn't really allowed to stay there. So this book really begins with my father becoming ill and me going back to Zimbabwe to see him. But at the time, I was in South Africa, in Zululand, in fact, on assignment for National Geographic, and I go up from there.
My guest is Peter Godwin, who is an award-winning author, journalist, and filmmaker. And he has written a second memoir called When a Crocodile Eats the Sun. It is published by Little Brown. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Peter Godwin, who has written a memoir called When a Crocodile Eats the Sun. It's published by Little Brown. And when we went into the break, we were talking about your return to your homeland, formerly Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, in 1996 because your father's health had begun to deteriorate. What had happened in the country in the intervening years? We talked earlier about an insurgency, the Nkomo insurgency. The Cold War had there was no Cold War anymore when you returned. Were the vestiges of the Cold War also gone?
Yes, I mean, what was important, really important for Zimbabwe, was when apartheid fell, which wasn't really until about 1993. So up until that point, Mugabe had a pretty free rein to do what he wanted, because there was this weird thing that if you attacked Zimbabwe, you appeared to be supporting apartheid because white South Africa was opposed to Mugabe, and that in many ways Mugabe was the sort of Mandela before Mandela was released. He was the big colossus on the African stage. And there is this theory, a sort of psychological theory, that he never really recovers from the release of Mandela, that he's sort of elbowed off the stage and never really gets over it.
But why do you think South Africa continues to take a rather kindly position in regard to him? Thabo Mbeki could have been a lot firmer in dealing with him, but he seems to almost be an enabler.
Right. I mean, in this current problems of Zimbabwe, which really began in 2000, the truth is that South Africa could pull the plug on Zimbabwe very easily, but the South African president Thabo Mbeki has preferred something which he calls quiet diplomacy, but seems pretty much silent to most people and has been very ineffectual. There are a number of theories about that. I mean, one is that he sort of venerates Mugabe as a kind of original liberation leader, and there is a tendency for these liberation leaders who then form governments, that they have a sort of messianic complex in a way, that they stay in power because they can't quite believe that anyone would ever eject them because they have freed the country.
Despite the fact that the country is in such a sorry state, the most recent figures are an inflation rate of 3,714%. That's almost impossible for me to conceive. I remember reading about Weimar Germany during the worst days, and I'm not sure that this is any better than that.
We're getting pretty close to the wheelbarrows of the Weimar Republic. I mean, it is extraordinary trying to live under that rate of hyperinflation. It beggars belief. You can't stay liquid at all. You can't ever have any money in the bank because it literally disappears for, you know, day to day. That people follow the person in the supermarket who goes around putting prices on, and they try and get ahead of the person just to buy them because the prices go up every day, literally.
But what does that mean for somebody who is poor to begin with in Zimbabwe?
Well, it means that they basically go into the so-called informal economy. And what Mugabe then did was all these informal traders and shantytown dwellers and things, he had this big operation to move them all out of town, and they bulldozed down all their shanties and they moved them into the bush and sort of dumped them. It was kind of almost Pol Pot-like.
You would think that would have led to a major new insurgency, but the only people who seem to be in opposition are people in the elite groups, and they are being beaten and being thrown into jail and being killed in some cases with hardly a peep from the rest of the world.
I think the opposition does come from all classes, but the big difference now, especially with the middle and upper middle class black Zimbabweans, is that they can leave, and so they vote with their feet. So if you go down to South Africa, many of the jobs there, you come across black Zimbabweans all the time, but you know, people think maybe 2 to 3 million in South Africa, but also hundreds of thousands in Australia and England and Canada here, and really the very people who would be the leaders of the revolution just leaving.
But also a brain drain that has to really be hurting the country on a lot of other levels.
Oh, I mean, more than hurting it. I mean, Zimbabwe is holed below the waterline now. I mean, I think that even if Mugabe were to go tomorrow, we're talking about damage that's so fundamental it's going to take decades, if not a generation, to fix.
While you were away, were you keeping tabs on the story? Were you in contact with your father?
Yes, I was, and I followed the story very closely, and I read everything I could about it. And of course, it's got easier and easier to follow these things with the internet now. And it's also fascinating to watch the way in which the exile community stays in touch in a way that it was unable to do pre-web, that they really talk to each other and they can organize more efficiently.
So getting back to the story, you return in the summer of 1996. Your father's health is deteriorating just as the country is beginning to fall apart. But you learned some surprising things about your father's past. I don't know if you want to reveal the biggest surprise, although some reviewers have.
Right. A lot of reviewers have now, so that cat is...
Does that bother you?
Well, you know, it's
you
funny.
You kind of build up to it.
I worked so hard on this book to kind of keep that information back so that it is a reveal. But now I feel like if you go online or whatever, you know, it's all over the web. I mean, it's the secret is not revealed in either the jacket copy or anything that would be, you know, immediately obvious. And it doesn't really happen until more than a third of the way through the book. But I think... I think it's no secret. I mean, essentially what happens is that my father, who I'd always thought was this sort of Brit striding through the bush in desert boots and a safari suit and a walrus moustache and kind of seemed completely English and spoke without trace of any accent, any other accent, turns out to be a Polish Jew, and had put this photograph up on the wall, an old sepia print of a young middle-aged couple and a young girl, and who I've never seen before, and these are in fact his parents and his sister. And it turns out that his name is not his own, my name is not my own, that he grew up in Warsaw, and that he was sent to sort of summer camp in England to learn English, and it was the summer of 1939, and while he was there on September the 1st, Hitler invaded Poland, and he never got back again, and they never got out, and that that he fought with the Free Polish Army and et cetera, and then and basically eventually came to Africa for a new start and changed his identity.
You discover that the reporter in you cannot be quelled. So while you're there, you wind up reporting about what you're seeing in Zimbabwe, and that is the eviction of white farmers.
Right. In fact, I mean, what I was doing then was basically I would collect any assignment I could that would send me back. So normally, as a condition of going back, I'd have to report for the New York Times Magazine or for National Geographic or for British papers, and was in on those right from the beginning, watching the white farm takeovers.
Well, there's no way to do that in an easy way, but Mugabe seemed to have come up with the worst solution possible.
Well, the truth is that everybody agreed that some form of land reform was necessary. And in fact, quite a lot of land reform had already been done, and it had stalled because the aid givers, the donors, had balked because it wasn't being done in a regular fashion. Mugabe, instead of giving the land to landless peasants, was giving it to his cronies, so they pulled the plug on the funding. But actually, when he did take over the land, it was nothing really to do with land hunger. It was in sort of furious response to having lost a referendum that would have increased his term in office, and he lashed out after that. I mean, literally within weeks of losing that referendum. And it wasn't spontaneous. I mean, I've been on enough farms to watch it. People were bussed in on government trucks and buses. They were paid a stipend. They weren't war vets. That they were, you know, a lot of them were just kids or from the militia.
And it had to have had a major effect on the economy. Going, Robert Mugabe ignoring his own advice to Mozambique.
The economy just collapsed. I mean, very, very quickly, that whole big agricultural sector collapsed, and with it, much of the economy. Inflation immediately spirals out of control. A lot of people start leaving of all races, and you can just see really from the year 2000, it really just sort of it collapses pretty quickly.
He was furious that they couldn't change the rules and extend his period in office, but he's just done that anyway.
Right, he did. He pushed it through anyway. I mean, he was just furious at the rejection, at the fact that, you know, he was that this could happen to him. I mean, that he and he's never really calmed down since. He's been on a kind of a spat of fury ever since.
My guest is Peter Godwin. His memoir, When a Crocodile Eats the Sun, a memoir of Africa, published by Little Brown. There have been all sorts of theories as to why he insists on holding on to control and why things have spiraled out of control the way they have. Someone told me recently with great certainty that Mugabe's behavior is a result of syphilis. Now, I don't know whether that's likely or not, but he does seem to have gone mad over recent years.
Yes, he does. I mean, yes and no. I've heard that rumor before. And I actually, the truth is that up until recently, he was a rather austere man, a man who lived a rather simple life. He doesn't appear to drink alcohol. He seemed, you know, he was Catholic educated and seemed almost Jesuitical in his appearance and practice. The conventional wisdom is good leader turned bad, that something happens, a flip switches, you know, a switch flips in Mugabe's psyche around 2000 and he goes nuts. But actually, if you look back at his resume, you will see, I think, there's been a completely consistent behavior. You look back at the leadership disputes within the liberation groups in the 70s and 80s, they were people, they often resulted in people dying, put it that way. People were murdered. If you look at that very first election in 1980, which he would have won anyway, instead of bringing his guerrillas into these assembly points, which he was supposed to do, he spread them out and they went around people saying, vote for us or we're killing. Then there was the Matabeleland massacre. And after that, there was a one-party state. So there was no one to beat up and intimidate. It wasn't necessary. So I think actually he's been kind of consistent.
But since part of the problem in gaining control in the past was tribal, and the original insurrection probably was as tribal as it was political. How do you get past that? Do you just simply kill a lot of people in the opposition tribe? Or do you suppress them the way Saddam Hussein suppressed all opposition in Iraq?
Well, I mean, that is a problem which dates back to colonialism insofar as a lot of African countries are these sort of bizarre shapes and sizes which lump together tribes which have a mutually antagonistic history. And it is a problem. It is a problem.
In the beginning, they all see themselves as opposed to the white colonial ruler. But then after that, we return to pre-colonial problems.
Right. To atavistic feuds and one thing and another. I mean, in Zimbabwe, what Mugabe did was he killed enough of the southern tribe, as it were, pour encourager les autres. So that, and then he forced them into a kind of unity pact, which still exists to this day within his ruling party.
There is the problem of AIDS on top of the economy. Now, almost 33% of Zimbabweans ages 15 to 49 are HIV positive. Is that a reason that Zimbabwe now has the lowest life expectancy in the world?
Yes, and the real problem is that in Zimbabwe you also have the lowest lifespan once you've been diagnosed with AIDS. I mean, a lot of other countries you survive for a much longer, and indeed, if you have retrovirals, indefinitely.
But so there's no drugs available?
Very few. Zimbabwe. I mean, there are some now, but very, very few people can afford them. People die very quickly once they've got AIDS.
And in most places, women live longer than men, but in Zimbabwe, women, the life expectancy is 34 years and men it's 37 years.
Right, and it's absolutely awful. You come across villages where the oldest person is maybe a sort of 13-year-old girl and they're trying to struggle on and go to school. I mean, it's just appalling.
You write, it is sometimes said that the worst thing to happen to Africa was the arrival of the white man and the second worst was his departure. Is the colonial past responsible for the state of Zimbabwe today? Because it started off, as I said, so hopefully, and it's a fairly rich country, isn't it?
Yes, it's quite well bestowed with natural resources, although it doesn't have too much. I think that countries like Angola and Nigeria, which have sort of huge stocks of oil, it actually is a very destabilizing influence. But Zimbabwe is rich. And it's
in minerals, mostly.
In minerals, and the land is very good, too. It's very fertile land. I think colonialism is partly to blame, but to be perfectly honest, I think we're sort of getting past that now. I think there's a point at which, I mean, you know, to use that phrase from one of President Bush's of speeches, sort of the soft bigotry of low expectations. I think that you reach a point where modern African leaders really are responsible for their own countries, and you can't keep blaming everything on history all the time.
Well, the French have maintained much more of a presence in their former colonies, but Britain has not.
Right. The French are much more hands-on neo-colonials. But it hasn't necessarily worked out any better for them. I mean, you look at what their big success story was Côte d'Ivoire, the Ivory Coast, and it's had a huge civil war now, and it's split down the middle between North and South and in terrible shape. So in a weird way, the British style of colonialism, which was much more hands-off, where you ruled through the chiefs and through the structure that was there, in a weird way, has less of an impact on traditional society. So there's more of that society survives when they get independent. Whereas the Portuguese and French style was much more intrusive, much more hands-on, and had a much more destructive impact on traditional societies.
So who's in line to replace Mugabe when he finally steps down next year or in 2010? Rulers of his sort generally kill off all their possible successors because they're afraid that there's going to be a coup attempt.
Well, there are a couple of people within his own party, but to be honest, they're pretty much, you know, died in the same vat as he is. I mean, there's one who was the commander of the army and another one who was the commander of the secret police. So neither of them fill my heart with joy, frankly.
And you said even if somebody brilliant came into power, the situation is so bad it will take quite a while for the country to recover.
Right. I mean, my great worry is that this enormous diaspora of Zimbabweans, very educated, often really the cream of the country, that they won't just all go rushing back. I mean, that they may never go back, and that we may have, the country may be just somewhat a different country.
Is that what happened in Uganda when Idi Amin expelled all of the Asians who had, in some cases, lived there for generations, their parents, yeah, and their grandparents had come. Many didn't go back, and it's been a hard struggle.
Right. I mean, and Yoweri Museveni, the president of Uganda, eventually did invite them back and restored a lot of their property. I'm talking more about the blacks who've gone, the indigenous Zimbabweans, that a lot of them won't go back either.
Do most of the families you grew up with, have they all left?
There are almost no whites left in Zimbabwe. I mean, those that are there tend to be over the age of about 70.
Everyone I've spoken to who grew up in the country still has an incredible love for it. Could you ever go back?
I would love to go back. I mean, I'm not sure I would ever live there all year round, you know, permanently. But I mean, I would love to be able to go back and spend great chunks of time there. Absolutely. I mean, I'd never left Africa until I was 18. And so for me, it's that thing that Doris Lessing talks about, that fable country, that mythic country that really, is in your heart.
Peter Godwin, who is an award-winning author, journalist, and filmmaker, has done a second installment of his memoirs. I suspect this is the last, at least for a while. Well, it brings us up to pretty close to today. When a Crocodile Eats the Sun, a memoir of Africa, published by Little Brown, and got wonderful reviews, all deserved. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.